Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The Israel-Gaza frontier was quiet Wednesday, following a barrage of dozens of mortar shells and rockets Tuesday, striking southern Israel, wounding three soldiers, and prompting retaliation, the worst violence since the 2014 Gaza war. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the military delivered what he called the strongest blow in years with tank fire and airstrikes aimed at more than 50 Hamas and Islamic Jihad targets. He warned such attacks would carry a heavy price. A Palestinian official credited Egyptian mediation for a ceasefire, although Israel stopped short of agreeing to it. Hamas and Islamic Jihad said the launching of rockets and mortar shells was in response to the killing of more than 100 Palestinians by Israeli troops along the border during weeks of protests. The UN Security Council met an emergency session Wednesday, Mideast envoy Nikolai Mladenov warning the region was on the brink of conflict.
I'm afraid that the last 2 days have seen the most serious escalation since the 2014 conflict between Hamas and Israel, and they have been a warning to all of us how close we are to the brink of war every day.
Kuwait blocked a U.S. draft statement strongly condemning the rocket and mortar fire from Gaza, offered a draft resolution offering to protection for Palestinians. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres Wednesday said resolving the crisis in central Mali, gripped by Islamist and ethnic violence, is key to peace across the country. The UN chief spoke as he visited the Mopti region. Visiting a command post, he also underscored the need to secure financial backing for the so-called G5 Sahel force, formed with troops from Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Chad, and Burkina Faso to confront the jihadist threat. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and senior North Korean official Kim Jong-chol held a dinner meeting in New York late Wednesday as the two sides continue preparing for a possible summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore, perhaps next month. More discussions are scheduled for Thursday. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said preparations also continue in Singapore and at the Korean truce village of Panmunjom.
As the president says, if it happens, we'll certainly be ready. The advance team led by Deputy Chief of Staff Joe Hagan met with the North Korean team in Singapore earlier today and again expected to do so tomorrow. We also have reports back from the DMZ, the U.S. delegation led by Ambassador Sung Kim met with North Korean officials earlier today as well, and their talks will continue. So far, the readout from these meetings has been positive, and we'll continue to move forward in them.
The top agenda item, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. As a Friday deadline approaches, France and Germany Wednesday vowed to respond firmly if the U.S. imposes tariffs on steel and aluminum imports due to a global glut that threatens U.S. manufacturers.
Nous n'accepterions pas que l'Europe...
French Economy Minister Bruno Le Maire said Europe will not accept to be stuck with tariffs. He said we're allies and friends of the U.S. U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross held out the hope the two sides could reach a deal in last-minute negotiations. Wednesday, China criticized a renewed U.S. threat to impose duties on $50 billion of Chinese imports over the issue of intellectual property theft. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta Wednesday vowed no mercy for thieves amid prosecution of dozens of accused of stealing tens of millions of dollars in public funds. The country's public prosecutor said a 24 civil servants and businessmen arrested for alleged fraudulent activity at the National Youth Service remain in custody and will remain there until a hearing scheduled for next week. New Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel flew to Caracas Wednesday in his first foreign trip in a show of solidarity with his Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro following his controversial re-election earlier this month. It was a ballot condemned by the U.S., European Union, and several Latin American countries as failing to meet democratic standards. In a symbolic move, the U.S. military renamed its Hawaii-based Pacific Command the Indo-Pacific Command, underscoring the growing importance of India. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said the move is in recognition of the increasing connectivity between the Indian and Pacific Oceans. U.S. stocks ended higher in Wednesday trading, with the benchmark Dow Jones recovering most of the losses sustained Tuesday to close at 24,067. U.S. economic growth in the first quarter revised downward to 2.2%. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe will hold its first election without founding President Mugabe on July 30th this year.
From today, the campaign is on. We campaign for ZANU-PF to give this country a resounding victory.
Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe will have analysis of what's next after the election. An opposition political coalition in the DRC has chosen its presidential candidate for the upcoming December election. Faculty and students at a Liberian university returned to the classrooms today after ending a boycott. And the UN Security Council votes today on new sanctions against South Sudan as President Salva Kiir lobbies Ethiopia.
Each time the peace process is about to start, the United States of America issue a number of standing orders with regards to sanctioning individuals within the government. So that one is translated by the rebels to be of their advantage.
Atain Wek Atain is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. Nearly 300,000 malnourished children in Mali are at risk of death, and snake bites are listed as a global health priority. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabweans will go to the polls come July 30th this year, according to an official statement by the country's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. The 75-year-old politician issued a government gazette and later told the ruling ZANU-PF party that his victory is certain. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare.
So from today, the campaign is on. We campaign for ZANU-PF to give this country a resounding victory. We should enjoy the little parties which are making noise around the country. But we must remain united, non-violent. The victory is ours.
That is Zimbabwe's caretaker president Emmerson Mnangagwa speaking to his ZANU-PF party supporters Wednesday in Harare. Earlier on, he had released a government gazette announcing that on July 30th, Zimbabwe would hold elections to choose their next president as well as members of parliament and local governments. The 8th of September is when a presidential runoff will be held in the event that there is no clear winner in the first round. But Trust Mahanda, the head of Zimbabwe's Election Resource Center, is cautious of the whole process.
A lot of people could be disenfranchised because of inefficient administration of the BVR. Political parties have been campaigning for a long time before the proclamation, and so they should be ready. The environment is conducive for elections, but there are pockets of intimidation, especially in rural areas. The court has just ruled out diaspora vote, and so in our humble submission, this excludes other citizens from casting their vote.
Zimbabwe's highest court Wednesday ruled that Zimbabweans who do not live in the country cannot take part in the country's elections. The Constitutional Court said that while dismissing a challenge to some parts of the country's electoral laws that prevent Zimbabweans living in the diaspora from taking part in their country's electoral processes. Belinda Chinowawa of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights Group said she made the application for some non-resident Zimbabweans as she hoped that her country would join other African countries like Ghana, Mozambique, and South Africa in allowing their diaspora citizens to vote from the countries where they live.
Well, we're naturally very disappointed because we really did believe that there is now a constitutional right to vote for all Zimbabweans, whether they're based in Zimbabwe or they're working from abroad. So we believe that as long as our clients were not convicted of any electoral offences, we believe that they firmly had a right to vote and that their residents in other countries should not have denied them that right.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa will, among others, face a challenge from 40-year-old Nelson Chamisa of the Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC. Sebastian Bofu for VOA News, Harare.
The announcement by Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa that the country will hold presidential election on July 30 of this year has been applauded by some of the country's lawyers, who say the move is in line with the country's constitution. Alex Mangaisa is a lawyer and current fellow at the Washington-based National Endowment for Democracy. He tells reporter Jonga Kandimiri of View Zimbabwe Service that the proclamation paves the way for all interested parties to start election preparations.
Well, I think the president has done what is required by law. As most people know by now, the election is supposed to be held at most within 30 days before the expiry of the current president's term. And that term expires on the 22nd of August this year, which means the election must be held at least by 21 July. So 30 July is within the time limit required by the Constitution. It also means that processes such as voter registration have to be concluded. According to the law, the registration has to be concluded at most 2 days after the proclamation, which means the last day of registration is the 1st of June. This also means that all those who are not yet registered or who have not yet checked their details should do so at the very least by the 1st of June 2018, that is within the next 2 days.
Can anyone who is going to participate or contest in the elections challenge the proclamation?
Unless there is some specific irregularities that have been identified, it's very difficult to challenge the election date. The election date, as I have said, is mandated by law. It has to be set within those 30 days before the expiry of the president's term. And the date that has been chosen is within that time. There are issues, of course, that may arise, such as the completion of the voter's roll. If it appears after the 1st of June that there is no voter's roll or the voter's roll is in such a state that it cannot be credibly used as a register for elections, then perhaps there might be reason to consider challenging the process, because what you don't want to have is to have processes that would taint the entire election process. So I think it's important to make sure that everything is in place. However, the burden of changing that date, I think, is very high, and anybody who challenges it would have to demonstrate an incredible amount of evidence as to why it should not be 30 July.
Now that the election date is announced, what is expected to follow? Things like the voter registration exercise and the nomination court?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As I said, the voter registration has to be concluded within 2 days after the proclamation, which means it has to be concluded by the 1st of June. There is also supposed to be a nomination court which has to sit at least 2 weeks, I believe, or at most within 3 weeks after the proclamation. And I understand it's going to be sometime between June 14 and June 21. It's important to have a nomination court. That is the occasion at which those who are contesting at presidential, parliamentary and council level have to register and to demonstrate that they qualify as candidates. That means they have to have the necessary monies ready to pay, and also to have the necessary signatures from nominators, those who are going to nominate them to stand for election. So it's an important period. A number of processes will be triggered, also including the issue of observers. Election observers now have to come into the country now that they know the election date to start the observation process, making sure that everything is being done according to the law and according to international standards.
Alex Mangaisa is a lawyer and current fellow at the Washington-based National Endowment for Democracy. He was speaking with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe Service. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 31st. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Martin Fayulu has been chosen as the presidential candidate of the opposition Dynamic Coalition in the country's December 23rd election. The opposition had been plagued by disunity with too many candidates, but Fayulu said it's all part of democracy, especially in the first round of the upcoming election.
I'm a candidate for the Dynamic of the Opposition, which is a coalition of almost 15 political parties. We are going to put ourselves together to compete for the incoming election. We'll be having the candidate for the Congress side, and then we'll have a candidate for local assembly. We'll have also candidate for the presidency. Then for the presidency, they have appointed me as their leader.
Mr. Fayulu, what does this say about the Rassemblement now? Is your coalition part of the Rassemblement, or you have been selected to go alone as a candidate outside the Rassemblement?
The Rassemblement, you have a group of political parties, and I'm in one of the group. We are leading Dynamic of the Opposition in the Rassemblement.
So why is it that the Rassemblement could not pick one candidate?
Yes, this is the first stage. We have started our group, which is the Dynamic of the Opposition, but we have left the room, the door is open for all the incoming meeting to choose all of us candidates who will be the candidates for the elections.
The government has criticized you, the opposition, as being divided. You have Katumbe, you have Tshisekedi, now you are a candidate. How possible is that you can win any election against President Kabila?
No, this is not the first in the world. If you go to the U.S. when you had election, the Republicans, they have Trump, they have Bush, they have Rubio, and so on and so forth. But the thing is, people have to express themselves, and then we put together criteria, and so following those criteria, we have to choose one of us. But we cannot, if some have the intention to be a candidate, nobody can stop him. At the end of the day, we have to work together, to agree together. That's what we have done.
Mr. Fayulu, I have a story that talked about President Joseph Kabila's billboards, posters of him in the capital city of Kinshasa, although the ruling party has not said that President Kabila is going to run. Do you believe President Kabila is going to run because of what's happening?
Kabila cannot run. This is a provocation. They are trying to provoke the Congolese to see at what extent they can push their projects. But the Kabila cannot run is written in our constitution, and the accord has confirmed that Kabila knows that he will not run at all. They are trying to distract people to buy time. At the end of the day, they will come with their own proposal. But for us, there is no way that Mr. Kabila will try to run. It has been prohibited by the constitution.
Martin Fayulu is the chosen presidential candidate of the opposition Dynamic Coalition in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. The UN Security Council is expected to vote today, Thursday, on whether to impose new sanctions on additional six South Sudanese officials for obstructing the peace process at the request of the United States. Ahead of the vote, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, says South Sudan has failed its children and it's time for the international community to act with one voice. In an opinion piece written in Wednesday's Washington Post, Ambassador Haley called on the U.N. Security Council to act. Meanwhile, President Salva Kiir flew to Ethiopia yesterday to appeal to the Ethiopian leaders to oppose new sanctions. Ethiopia's chair of the regional bloc, IGA, Dino Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Atanj says President Kiir will try to assure Prime Minister Ahmed his government is committed to restoring peace in South Sudan.
He's going to give his view on how the government feels or the political will that the government of South Sudan has shown in regards to expediting, you know, peace process. So let's wait and see what will come out.
When Minister Kiir meets with Prime Minister Ahmed, he will argue that U.S. and U.N. sanctions could hinder efforts to restore peace in South Sudan. according to Ateny.
The gap is always widened by the fact that each time the peace process is about to start, the United States of America issue a number of standing orders in regards to sanctioning individuals within the government. So that one is translated by the rebels to be of their advantage, and they become more intransigent.
Ethiopia is one of three current African non-permanent members of the UN Security Council. Members are expected to vote on the U.S. proposed sanctions in New York tomorrow. Cuba-based political analyst James Okuk says it is likely Kiir wants Ethiopia to influence other council members.
Maybe it's time, maybe Kiir wants to lobby so that Ethiopia doesn't vote in favor of the sanction. And it might also use its influence as an African country to convince others not to vote so that they don't get the 9 votes that are needed in the Security Council.
But Okuk says Mr. Kiir's lobbying efforts will only succeed if he assures the Ethiopian leader that he will make concessions on the contentious issues that prevented the warring parties from reaching a peace deal during the last round of talks.
He has to let go some of those positions and give it to the opposition. And if he does that, it means those who will go home or who will be changed from their position, they will not be happy. That is the tough time he is in now. But if he doesn't make those concessions, it means there will not be peace in the country. So this is the dilemma we are in.
Okuk says it is up to the president to make the concessions that will appease the opposition parties so peace can be achieved in South Sudan. Okuk warns if Kiir does not offer serious concessions, South Sudanese leaders could face more sanctions in the near future. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
In Liberia, students and faculty at Cuttington University in the central county of Bong have decided to return to the classrooms today, Thursday, and in weeks of protest. The students and faculty have been demanding the resignation of University President Dr. Herman Brown, whom they have accused of dictatorial leadership and bad labor practices. Their decision to end the protest followed the intervention of President George Weah. Lepolu Tolon is president of the Faculty Association. He says the government, through the Justice Minister, has promised to look into the remaining concerns of the students and faculty.
Not only that the students are returning to class on Thursday morning, but the faculty have agreed to return to this on the fact that they have put forth a demand from the Board of Trustees of Cuttington University on ground that the president and president of Dr. Herman B. Brown should step down simply because of several reasons, ranging from autocratic leadership, maladministration, and several scams, on which the faculty of the university would have no confidence in the leadership of Dr. Herman B. Brown. So as such, a resolution was passed by the General Assembly of the Faculty Association that they would not go to class on the Herman Brown step down. So upon the intervention of the president through the Minister of Justice and Education, this pleases the faculty member because this was one of their wishes, as well as the student public. So on this note, we spoke to our colleagues to immediately return to the state school so that our exams can resume.
Mr. Tolon, you know probably there are deeper problems perhaps at Cuttington besides your demand that the president should step down. I was reading an article that talked about sporadic supply of electricity on the university campus, the drop in government subsidies. Are these some of your concerns? And did President George Weah make any promise in terms of how to deal with these concerns?
Well, at the end of our discussion, the Minister of Justice, in person of Councillor Mustafa, he didn't promise the student that manna will fall from heaven, but he said they would speak to the president to see how there could be an increase in the allotment of electricity hour. Because, quite frankly, yes, there have been a drastic reduction in the number of hours in which electricity is provided to faculty and students of the university. Even once upon a time, the Vice President of the Republic of Liberia has to intervene. But the Vice President intervention, even though they committed 8,000 gallon fuel, but this intervention still has not proven to be much more different simply because of the way the administration has rationed this fuel. So given that fact, I think the problem of electricity still remains the same. That has also affected the quality of learning at the university, which we think Brown seems to care less about. And these were some of the grievances from the student angle as well as the faculty.
Part of the problem also is that the faculty, that you haven't been paid for at least 3 months or so. Is that true?
Yes. As we speak currently, there are some staff of the university who have not even received pay, even including some faculty members. But this doesn't really bother the president, as he's concerned about wasteful spending on issues that has no immediate benefit on the expansion and development of the university.
Mr. Tor Long, it's so nice to speak with you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, James Bote. It's a pleasure speaking to you.
Lepolu Tolon is president of the Faculty Association at Cuttington University. He is speaking with me from the central city of Bangka City in Liberia. The World Health Organization has decided to finally list snake bites as a global health priority, something health workers say has been needed for some time. More than 100,000 people die of snake bites each year, a fifth of them in Africa. Doctors Without Borders policy advisor Julien Porte spoke with Ricky Stryak about how this new classification will help workers address the 2.5 million venomous snake bites each year.
What it means is that it's 2.5 million cases of snake bite envenoming per year and leading to a high burden, 100,000 deaths and several times more amputations or disabilities. So it means many, many victims every year in the world. And these victims, most of the time, they live in rural, impoverished areas with very limited access to healthcare.
What does this resolution change now that the WHO has passed this resolution that recognizes snake bites as a global health priority? Will that mean better care? You know, how will that help treat snake bites, prevent snake bites, et cetera?
It's a political recognition, this resolution. So it's very important to have political will against this this public health issue, to recognize it and to start envisioning what needs to happen in the field. So the next step is going to implement concrete actions in the field, and some of them are already mentioned in the resolution. We need to know better the data where most cases take place. We need to distribute quality antivenoms more appropriately. We need to phase out antivenoms that are not of good quality. So in concrete terms, the resolution giving more details about what needs to happen in the field. First of all, we need to better regulate the quality of the existing antivenoms, to distribute them accordingly in the regions where there are the highest needs, and also to find solutions so that victims don't pay the full price of this treatment, because otherwise they will not be able to access the product.
Are there any innovative ways that people are dealing with snake bites in these rural areas? I would imagine, yes, of course, modern medicine is helpful and the international community is extremely welcome. Are there ways that the international community can learn from local methods of dealing with snake bites?
So there are a lot of traditional therapy that have been used across the different regions. For example, the black stone has been used extensively in many different regions of the world. It's supposed to absorb venom after the snake bite, but it's been found in lab experiments not to be very effective. There may be some good lessons learned from traditional therapies, but at this stage, very few of them have been tested in robust experiments. So what needs to happen is a dialogue with traditional therapists. We need to make sure that they do not cause more harm than good, because some procedures like incisions, for example, could actually cause bleeding and aggravate and worsen the bleeding.
That was Julien Porte, a policy advisor for Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Paris. That's it for this Thursday, May 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beffer, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we look at the heroic rescue of a child by a migrant from Mali and examine the forces that pushed him out of Africa and into Europe. What are the factors that propel people to leave their country? And why is Europe such an alluring destination? On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable.
Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.